And the final current event question I want to ask you, well, this is even more current than the Serpo story, and it's only, it's really not too, it's not even UFO related at all, but in a sense, kind of. And that's this Charlie Sheen story that's coming out. Charlie Sheen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's all about 9/11, 9/11 conspiracy, and you touched on 9/11 earlier.
I know that, yeah, Charlie Sheen has taken a lot of grief from, like, the conservative media establishment over this. I understand they're really all over him. Listen, I give the man a lot of credit. My father is a retired New York City police officer. I grew up in a family of New York City cops, and he's retired from that and worked for 7 years at the World Trade Center in New York City as a fire safety director. He wasn't just some guy there. He was an actual decent job. Because he was a bit older, he had Tuesdays off, and he happened not to be working on September 11th, although the man that he shared his job with, a very nice man that I had met, was killed that day. So 9/11, I mean, look, it was personal for everyone, but it had a certain level of personal connection to me. I'd been to the Trade Center with my family just a month before that whole thing came down, and I loved the World Trade Center. I'd been there many times. So as a result, like a lot of people, I was, let's say, traumatized by it, and I really wouldn't look at 9/11 for a good year and a half after the event. Meanwhile, however, and partly the reason simply was I had other things to do. I was new in the UFO field. I was trying to get myself established in that and writing articles about UFOs, not doing the 9/11 thing.
Yeah.
For which I didn't see an immediate connection to my field anyway.
Mm-hmm.
However, you write about conspiracies, people write to you, and I had a number of people would write to me and say things like, hey, Rich, you've got to look at 9/11. There's something going on there. This does not look right. For a long time, my answer was, hey, I'll get to it when I get to it. You may be right, you may not, I don't know. Well, I finally started looking at 9/11 in a thorough way in early 2003,
mm-hmm.
So a little more than a year after it. And the first book that I read was the best book I could ever have read on it, which was David Ray Griffin's very excellent The New Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
David Ray Griffin is a theologian. He's an academician, and he knows how to write about this in a way that's not sensationalistic.
Yeah.
That really just asks the right kinds of questions in the right tone, too.
Mm-hmm.
Griffin's book truly blew my mind. And what Griffin did that was so impressive was to just raise... He didn't try to answer all the questions. He just raised questions.
Yeah.
But one damning question after another. The thing is this now, that there is no doubt in my mind that I have now at this point looked at 9/11 a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to take everything that happened on that day and pick it up and drop it into another country, let's say China.
Yeah.
Right. Beijing. We would be looking at that and we would be saying, that looks very suspicious. But it happened here in the United States, and so all questions have been off limits right from the get-go.
Yeah.
There are a large number of absolutely bizarre and suspicious things that happened that day that have never been officially explained. For example, a lot of people have talked about the attack on the Pentagon, and rightly so. There's a lot that's not right about that. One of the main things is that the pilot who supposedly flew this 125-foot-wide Boeing 757, I mean, that's a big plane,
yeah,
who had been a student pilot who was trained on the tiny little puddle jumpers down in a Florida flight school, described by his instructor, incidentally, as an idiot. He's got this 757, big, big plane. Okay,
mm-hmm.
He's already turned it around 45 minutes into the flight and is coming back to D.C. now. The maneuver he did as he approached D.C. was like this 7,000-foot dive in 2 minutes while doing a corkscrew 360-degree spiral.
Yeah.
And then pulling up literally 20, 30 feet above the ground like Harry Potter on his broomstick. No radar guidance, finds a target, and boom. The thing about that is when radar operators in the D.C. region saw this, and when they saw that maneuver on the radar, every one of them breathed a sigh of relief because they said, oh, thank God, our fighter jets are here to save the day.
Huh.
Okay, this is not the move that you would get from a big commercial airline. I mean, just imagine, and picture in your mind, a big, big aircraft like this making such a maneuver.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Now, did that aircraft actually make such a maneuver? Well, I have a friend who flies 747s, and I asked him, could you do that with such an aircraft? I mean, this guy's an experienced pilot. He said, no way.
Yeah.
No way. He said, possibly a pre-programmed, like, flight plan, which may, you know, maybe you can commandeer the aircraft to make it do that possibly. So, now, I don't know the full answer to this, but I sure as hell would like to know what actually happened. And it just so happens that at least two cameras independently caught this event, neither of which had been released to this very day. It's been 4.5 years. Why can't you see it, and why can't I see it? You know, I'm not 5 years old. I have the right to see this event.
Yeah.
And yet, no one's been allowed to see it. There was a camera, for example, on the roof of a Sheraton Hotel in D.C. that apparently caught the whole thing, was confiscated instantly, has never been seen. There was also a video camera at this gas station right next to the Pentagon that apparently caught the whole thing somehow. That was confiscated immediately. These have never been shown ever since.
Yeah.
Now, you know, these by themselves do not prove that that it was an inside job, but you've really got to wonder. You have to wonder about the collapse of Building 7 in New York City in the Trade Center.
Yeah.
A lot of people are not aware of this. I'm sure many of your listeners are. But a lot of people don't realize that there were 7 buildings in the Trade Center complex. One of those buildings was itself a 47-story tall building, a big structure. And that was Building 7. And that building came down in a complete, total collapse at about 5:30 in the afternoon that day, 7 hours after the main event. Nothing hit that building. Okay? What caused it to collapse? And the thing was, FEMA did a year-long study of exactly this question because it's important. If you're an engineer, if you're an architect, and you get a steel frame structure that has a total collapse due to fire, that is enough to make you reevaluate your entire discipline. Because never in the history of steel frame construction had a fire cause a total collapse of a building. It never happened. It happened 3 times in one day.
Yeah.
Now, in the case of the 2 main towers, you could argue that the jet fuel from the jets caused a unique situation in which they blasted off the asbestos lining of the beams, melted it just enough to get the so-called pancaking that famously is used to explain this.
Yeah.
This is questionable by itself. But you can't even make that argument regarding Building 7. And so the question is, what caused that building to collapse? And FEMA's official conclusion a year later was, we do not know.
Huh.
And I'm like, you don't know? I've seen the video of this.
Yeah.
The top of the building comes straight down, and then the whole building just collapses, just like it was a controlled demolition.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now, even that is not completely damning. You could say, all right, well, they did have to bring it down. And in fact, there's good reason to believe they did. The former landlord, Larry Silverstein, seems to have said as much in an interview he did with PBS. It was very cryptic, and he never repeated it.
Yeah, I know.
So you might say, well, yeah, we did decide to bring it down because it seemed like it was unsafe. Okay, fine. But the point is this. You can't just wire a building with explosives in a couple of hours. It's an extended process, and it takes weeks and months, perhaps. You bring in scientists. You bring in technicians. Where do I put this explosive? Where do I put that one? You don't just go in while a building's on fire, which means that the building would have been pre-wired. Now, the real question is, if Building 7, well, everyone in the world who saw Buildings 1 and 2 come down, everyone, no exceptions, in the back of their mind thought, wow, almost as if it were brought down in a controlled demolition, because that's sure what it looked like.
Yeah.
And even if they were brought down in a controlled demolition, that also doesn't necessarily prove that it was an inside job. You could say, I mean, I can envision at least one scenario in which a responsible official is looking at this horror, right, and thinks, oh my God, if that building comes down in a way that's not straight down, it's going to cause even more damage, right? So you think, okay, let's just pull the damn thing. But we can never tell people.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe. Maybe. But if that's so, maybe I'm wrong here, I think people might understand. It's a tough decision that would have to be made. But yet, but there's no hint from the government that this was even the case.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, what we know, and then, but of course, it's hard to give these guys credit when so many other things happened that make you really wonder, like, for example, why NORAD seems to have gone to sleep all morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Defense Department gave absolutely conflicting explanations as to what fighter jets were scrambled. Well, we didn't scramble any. Oh, no, we did. 2 days later, they said, oh, no, we did. Because that was one thing that even the servile press did catch on. It's like, what, you didn't scramble any planes? And then they said, no, we did, but we just a little bit too late. In other words, the records on this were not clear, as far as what the Pentagon said. And just so much more. I mean, the steel, the beams of the Trade Center were not allowed to be forensically analyzed. They were all just shipped to China and India as scrap metal before any investigation could occur. That would have told you if the buildings were taken down at a demolition. And then, of course, you got just the all motivation. People say, well, why would the government do such a thing? And I mean, someone even asked this. It's sad to me that someone would actually have to be schooled in why this would be an inside job.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of reasons. All kinds of reasons for wanting, as Griffin called it, a new Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Griffin was simply quoting the statement from a paper by Bush's team called Project for a New American Century, in which they said, you know, what we really need is a new Pearl Harbor if we want to get our agenda through, and the agenda being a massive militarization of the U.S. economy, multi-billion dollar investment into space-based weaponry, and all this other stuff that both political parties, which are very warlike, would have probably wanted, except it was too expensive. And so what they needed was, they called it a catalyzing event, a new Pearl Harbor. The Patriot Act. What has happened in 50 years of UFO cover-up? The UFO thing is relevant to this, I'm absolutely convinced.
Yeah.
And this is why it's relevant. Over a 50-plus year period, what we have had is a kind of evolution of our government, in which this, I call it the national security state. One writer called it the homeland security state. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah.
There are different things you want to call it, the shadow government, whatever. It's the government that's behind the government. It's not the official government, but it's increasingly powerful and has done an end run around our official guy.
Yeah.
So we've had the evolution of this other structure of power that has incredible money and secrecy and latitude to do all the kinds of things it wants to do. And at a certain point in time, it becomes, no matter how silent you want this revolution to be, at a certain point in time, it becomes necessary to have, just like the stock market, there'll be a correction to the market if the fundamentals are not lined up with the realities. So too, I think what we experienced with 9/11 was a correction to the political market. But it was one that the controllers felt that they needed to have.
Yeah.
I said, okay, the time has come. We need to come out a little bit more with what's going on here. But we need something to allow us to do it without people getting all worked up.
Yeah.
And so 9/11 allows us to do this. And I think that's exactly what this is all about. So what I think is that 9/11 is, in fact, America's version of the Reichstag fire. For those who don't know their German history, allow me briefly to describe what I mean. In 1933, Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany. Now, he wasn't appointed dictator of Germany. He was appointed Chancellor by the aged President Paul von Hindenburg to lead like a coalition, okay, like Prime Minister, like Tony Blair, I guess. A month and a half into Hitler's chancellorship, the German parliament, known as the Reichstag, was in flames. It was obviously a work of arson. Everyone knew this. Now, how many years later? This is 73 years later. Historians today are unanimous in what they would say virtual certainty that the Nazis indeed caused that fire. They blamed it on the communists, but they themselves said it. And as a result of which, passed what became known as the Enabling Act, which gave Hitler emergency powers, which just happened to last for 12 years, okay, for the duration of the Third Reich. That was the foundation of the Third Reich. I think the parallels with our situation are absolutely real and profound. And even in the fact that it's been over 70 years and historians, they can't really prove even now that the Nazis set the fire.
Yeah.
And the reason is that the Nazis, I mean, we're pretty sure it was Reinhard Heydrich, Joseph Goebbels, and Hermann Göring, who were the three guys involved in organizing it. Pretty sure. But these guys, they were pretty tight-lipped about it. They covered their tracks reasonably well. And so absolute proof is just not there. Okay? It will never be there. And regarding 9/11, we're in the same situation. We're going to have a hell of a time trying to prove this.
Yeah.
It's going to be just like with the Kennedy assassination, in which, you know, it looks, smells, tastes, and, you know, whatever, like it, but you're not going to be able to prove it because the absolute damning evidence just is being withheld from you. Because the guys perpetrating this are just too professional. They knew what they were doing.
Exactly, yeah. Now, do you think with Sheen coming out and with your sort of like, with your research into fighting secrecy and fighting cover-up, do you think this Sheen thing is going to kind of be like all the other types of situations where it's sort of like a glimmer of hope and then we're going to get back, beaten back down, sort of?
I'm afraid that's probably most likely. You know, one can always hope that this will not be the case. I, for one, would like to give Charlie Sheen all the credit in the world for coming out, for saying what he has said. I mean, he's a Hollywood actor, and he's, I think he's an intelligent man, but the fact is, as a Hollywood actor, you know, that's only going to go so far.
Yeah.
Now, the good thing, though, is that as a Hollywood actor, he's famous.
Yeah.
And so he's going to get press, and I think the best thing that can come out of what Charlie Sheen has done is that other responsible academicians, and there are some of these people, in, you know, who are in the established structures,
yeah,
they are the ones who need, frankly, to put their ass out on the line and say, that's right. You know, I'm very suspicious of this, too, and here's why. And people need to be talking more and more about this. Without a true discussion of 9/11, we're just doomed. I mean, this is the problem that, you know, one can easily have with John Kerry in the last election. I didn't vote for Bush or Kerry. I voted for the... I was one of 200 people in my county who voted for the libertarian guy.
Nice, me too.
Al Begnarek. Well, Al was friendly with UFO disclosure, and I was totally down with that. Plus, I do kind of like the philosophy. I did, at one point, I voted for Ralph Nader. I voted for different people. I'm a fringy sort of guy.
Yeah.
But where did I go? Oh, with Kerry. You know, Kerry was talking the same nonsense as Bush was on the war in Iraq, for example. We're going to win this war in Iraq. I'm like, really? What dimension of reality do you expect to win this war in Iraq, dude? That war was lost the day that Abu Ghraib became an issue. And people don't get that even now, and they got their heads stuck in the Iraqi sand. All right, that war was lost that day.
Why
is
that?
No, hey, listen. Pretend that China were to say to America, America, your weapons of mass destruction are really annoying us. I mean, we do have a lot of them after all.
Yeah.
We're going to give you 1 month to disarm. And America says, up yours, China, right? And then China, let's say they invade. I don't know, they take over California. And they take over Alcatraz prison. And they start torturing Americans in Alcatraz prison. And they even beat an American general to death in Alcatraz prison. Okay? You think we'd have our own little intifada on the hands and we'd want to be beheading a few Chinese, by the way? I sure think so.
Yeah.
All right? The Iraqi people understand full well that the entire war is the whole ramp up to the war, that little tap dance Colin Powell did for the United Nations in 2003, all that was a facade, a charade, a pack of lies. The U.S. media to this day can't get past the idea of faulty intelligence. What a load of crap. Falsified intelligence is actually true.
Yeah.
In fact, the day that Powell gave that press conference for the UN, that little demonstration. He had all those images, intelligence satellite pictures. And as you recall, Powell said, well, you know, you can't necessarily make much of these pictures, but trust me, our analysts tell us that these are indeed sites of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. It so happens that there were a couple of men behind Powell, members of the CIA's NPIC, National Photographic Interpretation Center, and I listened to one of these men speak on a documentary very explicitly. He said, yeah, I was there. That was a tough day for us because, A, we weren't allowed to talk to the media. B, we all knew that none of those images showed any hint of weapons of mass destruction. Let that sink in for a minute.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to tell me Colin Powell didn't know? Or Bush or Rice or Rumsfeld or these guys didn't know? Give me a break.
Yeah.
How stupid am I supposed to be? So, no, clearly the entire Iraqi, and the Iraqi people know this. They know. Okay? They know that the war was a pretext. And it's basically a grab of their treasury. It was a grab of the Baghdad Museum. And it's a grab of their oil.
Yeah.
And who knows what else. And so, no, they will never, ever. There is no way. You know, you can only cause peace in that country by destroying it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and here's Kerry. I understand. You know, he's a Democrat. People were kind of on his case because he wasn't hawkish enough, supposedly. So he's got to act and talk the game. But Kerry talked the same nonsense that Bush did. And some of my friends said, well, he's only saying that because he has to. But Kerry had a chance to really get into it with 9/11. But, of course, you can only imagine. He would have been crucified on that.
Yeah. Howard Dean pretty much was, because he alluded to some stuff like
Dean, that. Well, Dean was destroyed by his own party.
Yeah.
Dean was the one Democrat in that whole campaign who actually had guts and was really maliciously, really destroyed by his own party. I mean, they caught him totally out of context. They had a microphone that was too close to him. And he wasn't screaming like a maniac like they made it out to be. Not at all. Not at all. Nothing like that.
Yeah.
Howard Dean is the one politician, and his wife too, are the people like in that whole campaign that I would like to get to know. They seem like really cool people to me. And he got railroaded. Dean had the guts to say this war is bogus. We have no reason to be there. You know, and for that, the Democratic Party was not willing to abide.
Yeah.
That leadership, they maybe rightly felt that he would get creamed, but maybe not rightly. You know what? What I discovered is, in my personal life, when I meet with people, people find out that I'm this UFO guy, and then they find out that I'm kind of into this alternative version of reality. But you know what? People who, they may not have a lot of education, they may not have a lot of time to research all the stuff that like we get into.
Yeah.
But there is a true hunger in this country, across the United States, by people for this kind of information. Because you know what? They know in their bones that there is something desperately wrong with this country right now. They know it.
Yeah.
And they don't necessarily have the knowledge. And so I think that, frankly, people are much more open to the truth than leaders tend to think.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's a situation akin to like a tinder box, you know, like in the old days, a dry, dry wood, and one spark can just set it aflame. I think that is absolutely the case with our society right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of other things that can lead to, you know, a real, rapid, unexpected breakdown on the structure of power, very much analogous to the situation that the old Soviet Union had. I mean, think about back in 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev became leader of the Soviet Union, and he starts talking this wonderful talk about glasnost and perestroika, openness and restructuring. In 1985, that was really radical stuff. And 6 years later, there was no Soviet Union. The country was, I mean, I don't think anyone expected that.
Yeah.
That country went away. What happened? I think I have an idea. I think that Gorbachev's process of reform spiraled absolutely out of his control. You know, you can't have it a little bit. So he starts talking about openness, and people in Lithuania are saying, hey, great, well, you know, if you're all for openness, to be honest with you, we don't want to be in your country.
Yeah.
You know, you took us over in 1940, and we were never happy about it. And Estonia and Latvia and all the other nationalities, and then the systematic falsification of history that occurred under Stalin, this stuff comes out, and suddenly you have a crisis of legitimacy, and I don't think Gorbachev was expecting that. The same thing here. We have a number of situations. Certainly UFO disclosure. And I started with this and didn't really finish my point like an hour ago. You start to, oh, you know, that happens.
Yeah.
You start to disclose, and one thing is going to lead to another, and that's going to lead to another. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, you're in a completely different ballgame here.
Yeah.
And suddenly the most amazing conspiracy, let's call it that, comes out, and a lot of heads are going to roll.
Yeah.
And it is just possible that in a situation like that, I mean, anything can be up for grabs.
Yeah.
And in a political situation, now, one thing I noticed historically is across in other nations, as well as the U.S., that during periods of political instability, these are the prime opportunities for UFO information to leak out. It happened, for example, and I mentioned indirectly in the United States in the 1970s after Watergate. I think that absolutely is the case. It happened directly in Spain in 1975 when Francisco Franco died. He was the dictator of that country for many years. And suddenly, boom, within a year or within the next 2 years, hundreds of Spanish military UFO documents came out.
Yeah.
And then stopped.
Yeah.
In China, with the death of Mao Zedong in 1976, same thing. You had this period of openness that, and in fact, to some extent, you still have that in China. But you definitely had this flowering of UFO research in China on the death of Mao. The collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, this extended political crisis that lasted several years, resulted in the release of a lot of Soviet UFO information. And that has stopped.
Yes.
So you get these windows, mm-hmm. these moments when something can come out. Now, let's say, I mean, because we are right now in 2006 in a situation that bears a lot of comparison to those other ones that I've just mentioned. And so is it possible that some other UFO information, confirmed information, can come out? The answer is yeah, definitely it's possible.
Yes.
And if it does, the thing that I think is that there's not a lot more room for give here.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems to me that this is stretched, this cover-up is stretched about as tight as you can stretch it.
Yeah.
And any more revelations that come out, I suspect, would have the potential of just blowing the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, I don't think there'll be a voluntary disclosure. If it happens, the government's hand will be forced. Something will happen, and they'll do it, and then they'll try to control the spin on it. That's what you got to watch for. If there is actually ever a disclosure, people have to be very, very astute as to who is doing the disclosing and for what purpose.
Exactly.
I guarantee you, they're going to be the evil ones who are going to try. I mean, let's call them that. They're going to try to maintain control over this situation in a post-disclosure world.
Yeah.
Guaranteed, you can take that to the bank.
Yeah.
So, I mean, some people in this field think once we get disclosure, it's going to be a new world. Greer says this, for example, and my friend Stephen Bassett, a lobbyist in Washington, says this.
Yep.
I'm less convinced, frankly. I would like to think it, but I think I know that I have a much more pessimistic attitude about humanity than either of those two,
yeah.
having spoken to them at length. So I don't know. I think I don't want to be defeatist. I like to fight the good fight too, but
yeah.
I don't want to underestimate these people with money and resources and power. See, that's just it. They've got the ability to control spin, and when you do that, that's going to be tough.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you just tell me about the next edition of the book? When we were setting up the interview, you said you were working on it. So how about a little preview?
Sure. I'll do my best. I'm actually in the heart of all of this right now. One thing I will say is that the amount of data that I've organized for this book is many, many times the amount of data that I had for the first volume. And when I say many times, I mean literally 6 to 7 to 8 times the amount of physical information. There's no way I'm going to be able to incorporate all of this. What I'm trying to do is distill it as best I can, kind of boil it down. I think that will happen successfully, so that the net result will be basically a 600-page book that will deal with the last 30, 35 years of UFO controversy. What I intend to do, the second book is going to be written in a very similar way to the first. I intend it to be a companion piece to the first book so that it will take the story. You'll have a lot of it is a kind of history of MUFON in a way, and MUFON, the organization, will get a lot of attention in this new book, and rightly so. There's an awful lot of information I've gathered on the posture of the U.S. military establishment with UFOs through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and in our own century. The problem that I have for the last, let's say, 15, 20 years of that is, you can't get too many government documents that are confirmatory about this. What you do have, however, there are sources of information that are reliable. There are journalistic sources, there's newspaper accounts that are confirmed. For example, there was the very famous case of two F-16 jets in 2002, right outside of Washington, D.C., chasing an unidentified object in the outskirts of Washington, D.C. This was confirmed by the U.S. Air Force. We know what happened. So, there are cases, in other words, that one can reliably point to as encounters by the U.S. military with UFOs, and I'll be highlighting all of those that are available to me, and there's a fair amount. I also, one thing that has just struck me is that there are several other kind of crescendos attempts to obtain UFO disclosure. You and I talked about it in these last couple of hours, in the late 70s and then again in the 90s. Those will be fairly prominent in my book. Discussion of NASA and whether or not we have reason to believe there's a secret space program.
Oh, cool.
As a covert space program. I absolutely intend to be dealing with that. And possible covert nature of Ronald Reagan's STI, the Star Wars program. I think that this is absolutely a valid point of discussion. And then the amazing explosion of, A, the UFO field itself in the late 1980s, early 90s. The field just blew up.
Yeah.
And this is a fascinating story. And indeed, the explosion of UFO evidence that has occurred really since the 1990s. Worldwide, you have people now with camcorders, very conveniently accessible.
Yeah.
This was not the case very much previous to the 1990s. Digital camera, everyone's got a digital camera, everyone's taking pictures. The amount of photographic and video evidence that is available now, honestly, unless someone has looked into finding out how much there is, they'd be amazed. It's staggering.
Yeah.
It's staggering. Every day there are more digital pictures taken of UFOs. Now, the problem, of course, with digital evidence, everyone knows, you can't analyze a digital image the way you can analyze a film negative.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you can do various types of investigation of some of these. You can interview witnesses. You can study the digital images. You just can't get the same level of forensic exactitude.
Yeah.
But you can. And so my point is that there is an absolutely astonishingly rich amount of UFO evidence. Only in the last year have I really been going into the last 5-10 years of this type of evidence, and it's amazing.
Yeah,
amazing stuff. And then a very, I think, in-depth discussion of of the likely state of our own secret technology programs in all the Area 51 type questions. The questions about technology in Southern California testing facilities, Northrop and Lockheed facilities. There have been a lot of aerospace watchers in Southern California basically hanging out, not just at Area 51 in other words, but down in California, observing and videotaping very, very exotic phenomena that appear to be advanced human experimental craft.
Yeah.
So there's a lot that's going on, and I intend to have a fairly extended treatment of the Belgian Triangle case of 1989-1990. I'm sure many people know about this. This is one of those pivotal events in which a triangle was very obviously photographed and videotaped, a perfect triangular craft, in 1989, and then in 1990 a number of times. Radar trackings of that object indicated maneuverability that is just off the charts.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, what I'd like to do with Volume 2 is to present, as I did with Volume 1, a good sampling of the UFO evidence, a kind of good first overview for any intelligent person who's just like getting and saying, what do I need to know here? And I want to try to do my best to do that.
That's awesome.
And then provide political analysis. One of the main sub-themes is going to be how I think. I mean, I'm going to try to argue that UFO secrecy, as we've said here, has been one of the real problems with the death of the American Republic. And I do believe this. And so I don't want to make this an overly political thing, but the fact is that it's hard to avoid.
Yeah.
You can't avoid politics when you discuss this. This is,
exactly, is
a political issue. And it's not a political issue in the conventional sense of a Republican versus Democrat or anything like that, but it is a fundamental political issue in the terms of do world citizens have a right to know about this when other citizens in their world community have access to this information?
Yeah.
You know?
And when do you expect the book to come out?
Well, I'm doing my best. I've really stepped into it by telling people I'll have it out by the end of this year, the end of 2006. I think that there's a reasonable chance that I can have it done by the end of this year. I am trying, believe me, like a madman,
yeah,
to get it done. Every time I think that I've got all my information, I run across something and I think, oh, damn, I've got to work this in.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty much done with that at this point. I have to be done. You could do that forever.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a lot. A number of people are continuing to offer to kind of help me out and send me research information. I'm very grateful for that. And if anyone listening has something useful, I would encourage them to email me. My email is keyhole, just like looking through a keyhole, K-E-Y-H-O-L-E, at rochester.rr.com. I would gratefully accept good research leads. But basically, I'm at the point where I'm trying to write this thing now, get the text done.
Yeah.
I'll put some pictures in the book this time, and the first book didn't have any pictures. And
you'll finally, go ahead.
Get the monkey off my back.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you'll finally stop having people ask you when Volume 2 will be coming out.
Yeah. Honestly, I cannot imagine, I really cannot imagine a project that will be more difficult than this one that I'm currently doing. I mean, not the first book, not any book that I think I'll ever write in the future is going to be as demanding as this book has been.
Yeah.
In the case of the first book, for instance, there was one previous example of a history that had been written of that period. That was the book by David Jacobs, The UFO Controversy in America, a book that was about half the length of my book, but still a good historical treatment. In this case, there is no book. There's not a single real bona fide history of the UFO phenomenon of the last 30, 35 years. There isn't. There are a number of good treatments of it. I mean, there are certainly smart people who've had insightful things to say, but there hasn't been a comprehensive overview.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, the database that I've compiled, what I've done is the way I was able to write the first book and what I'm doing for the second book is I compile a chronology.
Yeah.
So you go through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sources and you sift through, I sift through what I feel are relevant facts. And then I take that relevant fact and I put it into my database in a chronological fashion with all the other stuff that I've accumulated. That's what I do. And so that's how I was able to write the first book, and that's what I've done for this book. The chronology that I have amassed for this book would be a 3,000-plus page book.
Wow.
By comparison, the chronology I did for the first book would have been itself a 450 page book, which was quite substantial, and on that I based my book. But this is actually, it's just massive, and a lot of the information I had is kind of redundant from a lot of different sources, so that's okay, and it's not quite as big as it seems, but there's just so much there, and I just can't imagine any other project that I could possibly do that would take more out of me than this, and that would take as much of my commitment and energy as this book is now doing. But when it's done, I'll be very glad that it's done. I'll be proud of it, I hope, and then it'll have a life of its own. That's what happens with these books. The book gets out, and you discover, as I did with the first book, that, wow, you know, this actually affects people that I don't even know. And it's a humbling experience, I have to say. It's one that I take very seriously, I do, that I don't know how other writers are, but for me, the fact that I know that there are other people, especially people who are younger than me, who may read this, and it might affect them, and have an impact emotionally even on them, I take that very seriously, and I want to do the best job I can possibly do. So I'm trying to get the book done on time, but I will not rush it needlessly just to crank it out. It's not going to happen. I think, though, that I can legitimately get it done by the end of this year.
Nice. All right, and where can people get the first edition, UFOs and the National Security State Chronology of a Cover-Up, 1941 to 1973? That's what we've been talking about the last 3 hours or so. Where can they get it? Just about any bookseller?
Like most major booksellers, I think, seem to have it.
Or through Amazon.
Amazon is an easy one. Like Barnes & Noble and Borders, they stick it in the back with what they call speculation and New Age.
Yeah.
It really ticks me off, but there's nothing I can do about it. I think it should be with history, but they will not do that. Amazon is easy. You can go to my website. If you just type my name, Richard Dolan, in a search engine, the top link will probably be my website, and from my website, it's easy to link to Amazon.
Yep.
It's easy to email me that way, too. So that's probably a simple way to do it.
Okay, and the website's keyholepublishing.com.
That's right.
Yeah.
Just search my name, and that's an easy way to do it, too.
And what anything coming up on the horizon conference-wise?
I've gone kind of low-key this year on conferences. I used to speak in the years past. I've spoken many. This year, I've only been confirmed to speak at the forthcoming Crash Retrieval Conference, which will be in Las Vegas in November, very
okay.
distant. And in fact, Ryan Wood has told the world that my book will be done by then. So,
oh boy.
We'll see.
Thank you very much, Richard Dolan, for appearing on the show. I really loved this book. I can't emphasize it enough. It's been one of the very best UFO books that I've read, and I've read a ton of them. So I would put it in the top, like, three of UFO books that I've ever read, and if you haven't read it yet, pick it up, check it out. It's an awesome book, and it's just really an education for anybody in the UFO field. It really should be required reading for someone who wants to know what's going on in ufology, find out the history of it. I'll be praising it all day here if I keep talking. So thank you very much for being on the show, and thanks for writing an awesome book.
Tim, it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed talking with you very much, so thank you.
That does it for this week's edition of Been All of America Audio. Super huge thanks to Richard Dolan for sitting down and talking to us for so long, giving us so much time, 2 weeks worth of material, and just a veritable education in the history of ufology. His book, UFOs in the National Security State, check it out. If you haven't read it yet, you got to read this book. It is just awesome. and the website www.keyholepublishing.com. That's where you can get more information on Richard Dolan. Also want to thank Leslie, Chiron, and R. Lee of BenAllOfAmerica.com. They write the columns for BenAllOfAmerica.com. They help me produce this audio series. Leslie writes Gray Matters on Tuesday. Chiron writes the K-Files on Wednesday. R. Lee pops in every few Mondays for the Trickster's Realm. Also check out the BenAllOfAmerica.com mothership, known as the Benall Report. That's posted Fridays at BenAllOfAmerica.com. We're trying to serve you amazing stuff every day, so go to BenAllOfAmerica.com. There's something every day for you to enjoy about the world of the esoteric that we all so love. Want to throw in two plugs here. First, the theme music this week was provided by my old college friend, John Renault. He's an accomplished LA musician. You can find out more information on him at www.johnrenault.com. I'll spell that now for you. www.johnrenaud.com. I also want to give a plug to a contest that's being run by Leslie of BenAllOfAmerica.com, her blog, The Debris Field, in conjunction with the Sci-Fi Channel and the TV series Ghost Hunters, is running the Ghost Photo Contest. We talked about this last week. Let me give it to you for those who missed that. The premise is, if you live in the U.S. and you think you have a picture of a ghost, you send it in. All the pictures are cataloged at the website you'll be getting in a minute. And at the end of the month, everybody votes and prizes are awarded. So let me give you the prizes first, because I know that's all you're interested in, aren't you? For the first place, the winner, the champion, a Ghost Hunters Season 1 DVD collection and Ghost Hunters keyring. Second place, a Sci-Fi Channel t-shirt and Ghost Hunters keyring. Third place, a Sci-Fi Channel t-shirt. So there's real prizes involved. If you think you have a picture of a ghost, send it in, check it out. If you don't have a picture of a ghost, go to the website and check out the ghost pictures so you know which one you want to vote for as the champion, the best, the ghost photo that rules your world, if you will. The website, to get more information on the ghost photo contest, how to send in your picture, and how to look at the 12 that are already up, is ghostphotocontest.blogspot.com. Pretty simple. Type it in, go there, check it out, check out the pictures. If you got one, send it in. I know you want to win that DVD set. This is being brought to you by The Debris Field, Sci-Fi Channel, and Ghost Hunters, the TV series. Good luck to all who enter. Next week on Benall of America Audio, I cannot tell you his name yet. We are taping the interview on Monday. It is to be announced. I will announce who it is at the BenAllOfAmerica.com website, pretty much at the webpage where you found Richard Dolan Part 2 of 2. Scroll to the bottom of the screen. It says next week, and that says who the guest is for the next week. We'll fill that little portion in on Monday or Tuesday after we tape the interview, and then you'll know who's on next week. There's not much else to say, folks. I want to thank all the great listeners of Benall of America Audio. I've been getting your emails. I've been seeing the downloads. I know you're out there. I really appreciate it. It's your support and listenership and guest suggestions and you guys posting the links to Benall of America Audio on your blogs and your news groups and sending out the emails to people saying, check out this interview with blank. You're my street team, if you will, and you're getting the word on Benall of America Audio out, and I can see the growth in the audio series is tremendous. I want to thank all you great people out there for helping us out, and all the great listeners who are enjoying the Benall of America Audio series. We got a few weeks more rolling here in Benall of America Audio Season 1. As we head toward the season finale, it's going to be fireworks, folks. You're not going to believe it. Until you hear from me again next week, folks, this is Tim Benall, signing off.